This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. Happy July 4th to you, and thanks for listening. Hope you're enjoying this holiday. And freedom is the theme of this hour and this day, as we both celebrate our nation's birth and the very concept of freedom, relatively unknown to the world prior to 1776. And of course, we're reflecting on the events that have unfolded in Egypt this week. And we'll also talk about the anthem that helps to define our sense of freedom here in America. No, not the national anthem, the other one. The song that's definition has evolved over time only to rise unexpectedly to the level of a patriotic anthem. And we're asking you all this hour how you define freedom. What does it mean to you in your life, in your story in America?
Freedom is freedom from hunger.
Freedom is encouraging.
Freedom from financial insecurity.
Freedom is being able to make your own decisions.
Freedom is the best quality of life.
The action and ability to self-actualize, it's kind of unrestrained by outside forces.
It's a relationship that I have with society, and if society is allowing me to feel free, then I feel free.
Voices there from throughout New York, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to weigh in. But we begin now with three Egyptian Americans whose definitions and ideas of freedom and independence are being tested right now as Egypt continues to struggle with democracy. Well, hours after Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi, who's the country's first democratically elected president, was removed from power, the military suspended the constitution, installed an interim government under the leadership of Adli Mansour. He's the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And Morsi called the military's action a, quote, complete coup. Now, Morsi is under house arrest in military custody, along with many of his senior aides. Several high-ranking officials of the Muslim Brotherhood have also been taken into custody. Their satellite television network and other popular Islamist channels off the air. Adli Mansour, acting civilian leader of Egypt, is said to have the power to issue constitutional decrees during this interim period, and the military has called for the formation of a technocratic government to oversee all regular governmental affairs and establish a committee to draft constitutional amendments. The Constitutional Court is said to now determine the rules of parliamentary and presidential elections. So, while Egyptians might have some kind of roadmap there, the future there is far from certain. Well, with us this morning to reflect on this future are three Egyptian Americans. Nancy Youssef is professor of English at Baruch College. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Todd.
Sarah McGowan is a 27-year-old Egyptian American who was born and raised in Dayton, Ohio. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Todd.
Good to be with you. And Ahmed Soleiman, a 37-year-old Egyptian American attorney here in New York. Hi, Ahmed.
Hi, Todd.
Good to have you all. Welcome to you all and happy Independence Day. Nancy Youssef, welcome back to the show, and let me start with you. It has to be an uneasy feeling just a year after military takeover, a year after an election, rather, that involved a military takeover before it, to see tanks and armored personnel carriers in the streets of Cairo and other cities across Egypt yet again. Your thoughts?
An uneasy feeling. I'm a little surprised. I feel that people aren't looking at the same pictures that I'm looking at. I mean, there were 15 million people in the streets over the past several days. I see the tanks and I see the APC carriers, but what I also see are, a huge gathering of popular will to actually renew the promise of the revolution after Mubarak's ouster. So I'm not seeing this exactly as a coup.
Not as a coup, but as a popular uprising, and as you said, a sort of a continuation of the revolution, not a lapse.
A renewal, yeah.
A renewal. Sarah McGowan, do you agree with that? A year after democratic elections, the military's in the street again. Do you see this as a renewal or continuation?
Yeah, I think Nancy was on point. I feel this is more of a continuation. You'll see in pictures flags of the crescent and the cross. That's a form of unity. That's Muslims, Christians, all walks of life coming together and saying, we're not happy with the status quo. This is not what we talked about last year. Let's renew what we agreed upon or what we had in mind. So I don't see this as a coup either. A lot of people in the media are swinging it that way. And I feel like this is more of a group of people, regardless of their religious beliefs, coming together in a country that was being run a way that they didn't approve of and saying, we're not happy with this. This is not okay.
Then again, Ahmed Soliman, a 36-year-old Egyptian-American attorney, not being happy with the status quo in a democracy, one hopes, leads to political activity, another election, and getting the guy out who you don't like, not the way we've seen it in the last couple of days, ideally.
Well, legally speaking, people seem to forget that in America, we don't have to wait for the next election before we change our president. Our Constitution has an impeachment mechanism in place. What happened here is that the Muslim Brotherhood wrote a constitution that did not have an impeachment mechanism. That was part of their monopolization of power. So without an impeachment mechanism in place, the people had no choice but to take to the streets. What essentially happened here was not a coup, but a de facto impeachment. And so therefore, I think they had no choice to do that. And it's very hopeful that moving forward, they'll have a much better democratic process in place than they did a year ago.
And that makes me wonder, Ahmed Soliman, how much confidence you have in the interim period and stability in Egypt. Many of the experts that we've talked to over the last couple of days make the point that it is extremely unclear who can lead this country in a way that's stable and that gets any measure of consensus between Islamists and secularists and all of the different groups, including the Muslim Brotherhood, of course. How much confidence do you have that Egypt is poised for stability now?
I'm very confident, and much more than I was a year ago, and I'll tell you why. If the Muslim Brotherhood had not run and taken power a year ago, they would still have tremendous influence over the people and the population. But because they did take power a year ago and people saw that they were not able to govern, the people essentially got them out of their system. And they have far less influence now, and there's a better consensus already on the street about what's the type of leader they need to choose moving forward. Last time, the Muslim Brotherhood actually only had a minority of the support from the people. But what happened was the non-Muslim Brotherhood candidates split the vote, sort of the same way Al Gore and Ralph Nader did in Florida in 2000. And so you ended up having the Muslim Brotherhood win the plurality. This time, because they don't have any more support, I think there's a better consensus that they need to rally behind a candidate that'll be more secular, maybe a little bit more worldly, and more focused on governing than they are on social issues the way the Brotherhood was. For us to see the Christian leadership and the Muslim leadership and the military leadership and people like El Baradei standing together when this announcement was made yesterday, I think is very hopeful that there's a little bit more unison moving forward.
Still, Nancy Youssef, at Baruch College, there doesn't seem to be any practical way, maybe any desirable way, to marginalize the Muslim Brotherhood. Maybe a plurality and not a majority is what they won, but they were democratically elected, and they have a lot of supporters.
Well, democratically elected under a rushed election where there was a lot of dispute about the process, I think we need to be careful with that term as well. We have free and fair elections in this country, and yet we also have people that might question the legitimacy of voting rights here. So I think we need to be careful with those terms and understand that this is a long process. I think we also need to distinguish between the Muslim Brotherhood as a political party and quote-unquote Islamism. There are many devout Muslims in Egypt, and many who might want to see Islam play a greater role in the governance of the country. But that sentiment, that political belief, needs to be distinguished from a particular party monopolizing power. So I agree with much of what I heard Ahmed say about this.
Sarah McGowan, you talked about a renewal of the revolution, and I wonder about your confidence in the military. Of course, as you remember probably better than I, in the first phase of this revolution, it was many of the same protesters in the street protesting the military rule of the very apparatus that's in charge now. Your confidence in the military to shepherd Egypt through an interim period and responsibly hand over power in a way that that fosters freedom and democracy, you're confident about that?
More so than I was a year ago. I feel as though Ahmed said it right. You know, before the Muslim Brotherhood was very apparent, and they did, they split the vote, and people were kind of, I could say my family wasn't overly happy about it. But, you know, it is what it is. We're stronger today than we were a year ago. I think the military sees that. They see this uprising of people, these protests, these gatherings as, you know, an informal impeachment, exactly what he said. And I'm more confident today than I was a year ago in saying I feel like we're headed in the right direction. There's still a little bit of nervousness, of course. You never know what can happen, but far more confident than I was before.
Ahmed Suleiman, half Egyptian, half American you are. I don't know if you consider it half and half, but Egyptian American anyway. What about your American government? Satisfied with sort of the hands-off approach and no fingerprint statements coming from the White House at this time? Is that appropriate?
Well, I mean, they have no choice but to do that. I mean, if I was in Obama's position, I would be doing the same thing. They have to tread carefully here. They have to show that they support democracy, and they have to push that new elections will happen as soon as possible, and they have to somewhat, as he did, condemn the fact that, you know, a constitutionally elected president was ousted. But like I said, you know, it was more of a de facto impeachment. So how can he speak out against the will of the people? As a friend of mine recently said, who are we to judge their decision? If 33 million people over there in Egypt take to the streets, they must have their reasons. And, you know, it's their country and they'll do what they want. So, you know, we have to support the people. And if that means that they wanted him out and they want to have a new interim constitution, then that's really what Obama should be doing. So he's kind of walking both sides of the fence, and I don't blame him for that.
There's the voices there of three Egyptian Americans just a day after the removal of Muslim Brotherhood party member and Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi from his post in Egypt by the military. We were just speaking with Ahmed Suleiman, 36-year-old Egyptian American in New York, Sarah McGowan, 27-year-old Egyptian American, born and raised in Dayton, Ohio, and our friend Nancy Youssef, professor of English at Baruch College. Thanks to all three of you.
Thanks.
Thanks, Todd.
Well, the removal of Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi and the start of an interim government could offer a new set of complications for the United States and its role in the Middle East. As a strategic partner in the Middle East, the United States will be watching to see how the interim government in Egypt and the future leadership there maintains its commitment to the 1979 Camp David Accords, opening passageways for U.S. Navy ships through the Suez Canal, access to oil. The list of potential complications is long. And at the same time, the U.S. pours $1.3 billion in military aid into Egypt every year. But federal law requires that non-humanitarian aid is cut off if, and I'm quoting here, the government of any country whose duly elected head of government is deposed by a military coup d'etat or decree, or after the date of enactment of this act, a coup d'etat or decree in which the military plays a decisive role, end quote. That's from the statute. The Obama administration has been careful not to call yesterday's event a military coup, and now you know why. But the White House did say that, the president did say, rather, that he is deeply concerned by the military's removal of Mohamed Morsi. Well, joining us now to help sort this out, David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for our partner in the New York Times. Hi, David.
Good to be with you, Todd. Happy 4th of July.
And to you, and welcome back. And I'm glad you're here because I want to start with the somewhat legally tortured language of the statute governing aid to Egypt that I just read there. Everyone else, including me, including everyone on radio and newspapers and television, is calling this what it is, a coup, but the White House isn't.
That's right, because if they have to cut off the roughly $1.3 billion in annual aid that goes to the military in Egypt has always regarded that as the payment for keeping the Camp David Accords alive. And while there's no place where you'll ever find that written, that is, in fact, the way they regard it when you go and you talk to them.
It's the buy-off.
So it is,
David,
it's difficult.
It's the buy-off, essentially, for keeping the peace with Israel.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So it's a very difficult situation for them in that they don't want to make any declaration, particularly in a case where you had what I guess you might call sort of a popular coup. I mean, it was remarkable yesterday when you saw the military leader there standing up next to Mohamed El-Baradei, the former head of the International Atomic Energy Agency and considered a liberal in Egyptian politics, and some of the Salafis, the very ultra-conservatives. So, you know, they've got a coup, but a popular one, and that's thus the reason they don't want to call it a coup.
Meanwhile, there are ultra-conservatives, David Sanger, who appear to be bought in to the concept of the interim government and the technocratic government. But we've seen quotes in your paper, we've heard them on this show, of members of the Muslim Brotherhood who feel disenfranchised by this whole process. They were democratically elected. Now they're out. And the United States has to be concerned that Islamists who have been convinced up until now to participate in a democratic process might conclude that only other means are really available to further their goals. I'm talking about potential violence.
It's a real worry, Todd. And I think that if you just sort of step back from this, what we have seen is what happens when you have the rise of an illiberal democracy. So they had elections. I was there during some of the parliamentary elections about a year and a half ago. They were run fairly. By and large, the Muslim Brotherhood was easily the best organized, and you saw the kind of results they had. But once in power, they did exactly what they said they wouldn't do, which is that they designed a constitution and other laws to cut out a lot of the other participants in the process. It was very little protection of others' rights. And in the end, that was their undoing.
During the interim phase then and the new constitution, eventually there will be new elections, or at least we can assume there will be. It would seem to me that the United States would place a very high priority on inclusion for the Muslim Brotherhood. They may not be in power from here on out, but it seems like it would be a mistake to marginalize them completely given what we just talked about.
That's right. And if you looked at President Obama's statement yesterday, it was all about inclusion and it was all about process. It didn't mention any party. And so the U.S. puts itself in the position, as it did in the last election a year ago, of arguing for a fair, democratically run election. Now, the downside of that is that once you've done that, if you don't like the result, if the Muslim Brotherhood wins, you've then got to go work with that government. And that's one of the reasons that you're seeing so much so many attacks in the Egyptian media aimed at the American ambassador in Egypt, because she has been meeting so regularly with the Muslim Brotherhood. Well, what she's supposed to do, they were the elected government, at least until yesterday.
Before we let you go, David Sanger, in the couple seconds we have left, one can't really talk about instability in the Middle East without talking about the Suez Canal, especially in Egypt. What are the conversations like between American diplomats, perhaps, and Egyptian leaders right now in making sure that waterway stays open despite instability? It's important.
You know, it is important, and the issue came up consistently a year and a half ago, but there's been no real threat to the Suez, and one of the reasons is it's one of the few parts of the Egyptian economy that's still working, and so everyone from the military to the Muslim Brotherhood had an interest in keeping it flowing.
Everybody's bought into that, and oil pipelines as well, I assume?
Yeah, that was a little bit rougher in the pipelines that would in some of the places, but for most of the case, that has been the case. You know, the one thing you can say about the military, they control much of the economy, and as a result, they put a high premium on the economy working, and that's what has not been happening by and large in Egypt in the past year.
And the military also understands the $1.5 billion or so in aid that they are getting from us, which is how we started this conversation, exactly where it should have started and should have ended when it comes to U.S. interests there. David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent for our partner in the New York Times. Thanks, David.
Thank you, Todd.
Well, all this hour on this July 4th holiday, we're asking you, what does freedom mean to you?
Freedom is being able to make your own decisions without fear of being like impeded by the actions or choices of others. I think an aspect of freedom is being able to do what you want and allowing other people to do what they want, but not allowing too much conflict.
Call us at 8778 My Take. Be part of the conversation.
$550,000. Last call.
So,
$50,000. What you just heard there was the sound of $550,000 being spent at an auction last week in New York City. What was going for more than $500,000? It was a rare edition of the first newspaper printing the Declaration of Independence on July 6, 1776. The Pennsylvania Evening Post was the first newspaper to print a copy of the Declaration, and picking up a newspaper was the way that most colonists first read the words, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal." Seth Kaller is a leading expert in acquiring, authenticating, and appraising American historic documents and artifacts. He partnered with the Robert A. Siegel Auction G Galleries to auction off this rare piece of American history. And before John Hockenberry left for Africa, he sat down with Seth Kaller to talk about the auction of this rare and amazing document.
With the auction buyer's fee, $632,500 is an auction record for any historic newspaper.
And as a newspaper edition of the Declaration of Independence, this is significant historically because it's really the first chance most people probably had to actually see it.
That's right. What people think of as the original, the manuscript in the National Archives, didn't even exist until the next month. So the real documents that got out and that told Americans that they were free and independent was a newspaper like this, or broadside, a single printed page. And this being the first, many of the ones that followed, if you were in Massachusetts, for instance, you were probably reading the news that was taken from this newspaper and recopied. These were printed in quantities, but very few survive. And people who have them didn't necessarily know that they did.
Can I take a look at the
document
here? Visually, for radio, this isn't exactly the most electrifying moment for our audience, but I'm just going to indulge right here. Wow. And did they get it right?
No significant typos. There is one big thing you might notice in the heading, because we have this image of the manuscript that says the unanimous declaration. And
right.
This one doesn't say that.
It says, "In Congress, July 4th, 1776, a declaration by the representatives of the United States of America in General Congress assembled."
And the reason is that it was not unanimous on July 4th. So New York abstained.
That's right.
And they didn't. And Congress had the forethought to not have that manuscript written until after New York had sent its delegates with new instructions to vote yes.
So it was still a developing story.
That's right.
From a newspaper perspective. The Pennsylvania Evening Post, price only 2 coppers, published every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday evenings. This would have been the Saturday edition. That's amazing.
It's completed on page 2, where it has John Hancock and Charles Thompson's name. Those are the only two people who actually signed the declaration on July 4th.
As you hold this, thinking about July 4th, what does this mean in terms of the sort of annals of freedom in America? You get any goosebumps?
Absolutely. The Constitution is what we live by. That's really our government. But this is what made our government important. This is why America is the beacon of freedom around the world. And to me, all of American history, including what happened today, can really be viewed with the question, to whom does this document apply? And that, I think, it's still a current thing to me, the Declaration of Independence from 1776, but it is really informing parts of the debate that are going on even today.
Hot off the presses every day of the week.
Yeah.
Seth Kaller, leading expert in acquiring, authenticating, and appraising American historical documents and artifacts on the auction sale of a rare edition of the first newspaper printing of the Declaration of Independence. Thanks so much, Seth.
Thanks for having me.
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
What day does Hollywood love better than the 4th of July? Box offices open up for some of the summer's big expected hits. Yesterday on the show, we talked about the Disney remake of The Lone Ranger. There are a couple of other movies that we didn't get to get to, so we wanted to take today to talk about Steve Carell back as the voice of Gru, who's recruited by the Anti-Villain League, apparently, in Despicable Me 2. And we also have a stand-up comedy concert film starring one of the hottest comedians today. That's Kevin Hart. Let me explain. Of course, with us, I don't have to explain to you that it's Kristen Meinzer and Rafer Guzman, our movie team and host of the Takeaways Movie Date podcast. Hi, guys.
Hi. Happy 4th.
Hi, Todd.
Welcome. We're going to do trivia, but let's leave it to the end because we have a special 4th of July themed trivia. We'll do that at the end. Guys, let's start with Despicable Me. Stars the voices of Steve Carell, as I mentioned, Kristen Wiig, Benjamin Bratt, Russell Brand, who I love. This time around, Gru is working for the good guys when the Anti-Villain League asks for his help. Listen.
I have accepted a new job.
Whoa, really?
Yes, I have been recruited by a top secret agency to go undercover and save the world.
You're gonna be a spy?
That's right, baby. Gru's back in the game with gadgets and weapons and cool cars, the whole deal.
Kristen Meinzer, I could listen to that voiceover all day without seeing the movie, or should I see the movie?
You know, that's one of the high points of the movie. Gru, his relationship with his three daughters who he adopted in the first movie, that's all fine and good. There's also a romance with the agent who recruits him into the Anti-Villain League, Lucy, who's played by the voice of Kristen Wiig. All of that stuff is delightful, but I just felt so overwhelmed by these yellow minions. You might see them on all of the billboards and all the print ads.
Little Eggmen.
Yeah, and all they do is ruin the movie anytime it's good, anytime you're getting into it. They just step onto screen and start mumbling and falling over and acting like the Three Stooges. And so I have to say it wasn't the best experience for me because of the minions.
Rafer, my experience with you is that you tend to like these animated movies. What about this one?
You know, I was actually not a fan of the first one, but I like this one a little better, mostly because of Kristen Wiig. I think she is really appealing. I think the romance subplot is appealing. I agree with Kristen. The minions have always irritated me, but they feel a little more inspired in this one, too. They do a very good boys to men imitation in this film. So I had to give them points for that.
All right. Kevin Hart is a great comedian. I'm a fan of his. And there's a new documentary concert. Well, it's a concert film out called Kevin Hart, Let Me Explain. Let's listen to Kevin Hart.
Here's the beautiful thing about me feeding pigeons. When I was done feeding the pigeons, I didn't have to lie about it. See, when you marry, you lie about it like that. Because you don't believe that your wife would ever believe that you were doing something as dumb as feeding some pigeons.
Rafer Guzman, nobody has more energy on stage right now than Kevin Hart.
That's true. He's a lot of fun. I really liked him in Think Like a Man. I thought he was a real show stealer in that. And I've never seen his stand-up before, so this was my first introduction. I was a little disappointed. I think they spend a little too much time interviewing fans and friends who say only good things about him, and they try to pump up his career. But the material itself, a little weak, not as sharp, not as energetic as I would have hoped. Although, the screening I was in, people were laughing hysterically, so maybe it was just me.
And Kevin Hart does have a real self-effacing style that I enjoy. He's really good at making fun of himself. All right, that's Rafer Guzman from Newsday. Guys, we have a special trivia today, 4th of July theme. Now, this is an audio trivia. I'm going easy on you today. I'm going to tell you right off the bat that this is a gimme, and you're going to know this one, or at least you better. Listen to this scene, a famous 4th of July scene from the movies.
Larry, if we make an effort today, we might be able to save August.
August? Tomorrow's the 4th of July, and we will be open for business. Going to be one of the best summers we've ever had.
Kristen Meinzer, what movie is that arguing on the beach about staying open for the 4th of July?
Oh my gosh, I wish I had any idea, Todd.
Oh,
I have no
dear.
Idea at all.
Rafer, save us.
That's got to be Jaws.
That's got to be Jaws,
oh.
Rafer Guzman. That is Jaws. Will they keep the beach open on the 4th of July? Not with a shark in the water. Kristen Meinzer and Rafer Guzman, our Movie Date team. You can always subscribe to the Movie Date Podcast at moviedatepodcast.org. Thanks, guys. Happy 4th.
Thanks, Todd.
Thanks, Todd.
Sounds of celebrations in the streets of Egypt just 2 years ago as Hosni Mubarak stepped down from power. And there was a similar feeling last night. The scene is the Egyptian military announced that President Mohamed Morsi had been deposed. And today, Adli Mansour, Chief Justice of Egypt's Supreme Constitutional Court, was sworn in as the new caretaker leader and acting head of state. As the news yesterday was breaking of Morsi's ouster from power, we spoke with one of the activists who supported the protests. Dalia Ziada is an Egyptian blogger and activist based in Cairo. And when we spoke, she said Egyptians couldn't wait to begin the celebrations.
I'm here right now with my family. The whole family is gathering to celebrate, and I think this is happening in almost in every house in Egypt. Tahrir Square is celebrating. Other squares in other cities are celebrating. Our demand is met, and our voice heard.
But for all the jubilation in the streets and celebrations in many homes throughout Egypt, there is also a significant portion of the population mourning the loss of Mohamed Morsi today and anxious about the future of this unstable country.
What do you want? Democracy!
What do you want?
Democracy!
What do you want?
Democracy!
It's a coup! It's a coup!
It's a coup! It's a coup!
That's the sound of Morsi supporters protesting the removal of their president in Egypt yesterday. David Kirkpatrick, Cairo bureau chief for our partner in the New York Times, joins us now. Hi, David.
Hello.
David, plenty of reporting in the New York Times from your colleague, Karim Fahim, especially about the unseen, largely unseen to the West anyway, group of people in the streets of Cairo, hundreds of thousands of supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood and Mohamed Morsi, completely dejected today.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm surprised that it's not more visible in the West, because it's a very big crowd here over the last almost a week, you know, tens of thousands out on the streets in Cairo and around the country, representing a pretty good cross section of this country that does not want to see President Morsi go. You know, at least a quarter of the country, he won half the votes, and he's probably got a level of support a little bit lower than that, but not too far today. And what we're seeing now in Egypt is that this new popular uprising has a kind of repressive element to it. We're seeing Islamist television stations taken off the air, their crews summarily arrested, senior leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood, including their top spiritual leader, also under arrest. President Morsi himself locked in a military barracks some way. None of their top leaders can speak to their families or colleagues. So it is indeed a scary time for Egyptian Islamists, many of whom fear they could be on the receiving end of yet another crackdown like they've endured periodically since Nasser came to power in 1952. There's no way to sugarcoat the fact that people are being locked in jail for the content of their political beliefs. And these are not people who have a history of violence or who can be credibly alleged to be plotting violence.
Is there any sense that this crackdown or the possible crackdown, David Kirkpatrick, is punitive or is it merely strategic? Whether after this sort of initial period of uncertainty, whether there's any indication that people who are being held for political speech or political beliefs will be quickly released or if this is completely open-ended?
That's a good question. You know, I spoke this morning to Mohamed El-Baradei, a Nobel Prize winner and a liberal leader here who supported the military takeover. And he says that they're calling on the military to be inclusive, to allow the Muslim Brotherhood to participate just like everyone else in the political process. That's going to be a big question, whether that's really allowed to happen. If so, the Brotherhood will probably resume a leading role in the parliament as it had before if there are free and fair elections. And I can't imagine that parliamentary majority is going to be very excited about the way things have unfolded here. You know, to be sure, a lot of people wanted them out. And yet it's hard to get from, well, you guys are incompetent or unpopular to you deserve to be locked in jail and we'll have a military coup.
And also the reality on the ground, as I understand it, that it's hard to get to a vision of a stable and governable Egypt without including the Muslim Brotherhood, which, as you said, has fairly broad popular support, even if they in governance, they weren't great at it.
Yes. One of the interesting and perhaps hopeful things here is that one of the newly formed ultra-conservative parties, the Salafi parties, who people in the West usually consider kind of just plainly more radical than the Brotherhood, they lined up behind the generals. They said, look, the Brotherhood here has made a terrible mistake by hogging all the power. They've failed to include their opponents. They're doing a bad job. Something's got to change. We need new presidential elections. And so there was a Salafi sheikh behind the general when he announced the takeover, and they will be a part of the process going forward. So there's an Islamist element to this new plan. There are already moves to include Islamists, if not per se, the Muslim Brotherhood. And that diffuses some of the really dangerous, really polarizing secularist versus Islamist, you know, godless versus godly conflict that you don't want here, you don't want in the United States, you don't want anywhere.
You don't want it, and yet the reporting from your bureau, also from the street, we should add, has some very disturbing undertones, quotes talking to supporters of Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood in the streets, basically saying they feel oppressed, they feel dejected, and the only way out of this is civil war. It's very scary.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we're going to see two conflicting narratives. One is a popular uprising against a not sufficiently inclusive, not sufficiently democratic ruler. And the other is going to be a military coup against Islamists on the basis of the content of their beliefs, that secular forces, the old regime military and security institutions, the old regime judges, their friends in the West, none of these people could abide by allowing Islamists to come to power. They just don't like Islam. That's the really dangerous thing that's going to be echoing now in some Islamist circles.
And do we have any sense, David Kirkpatrick, of the timeline? This might not be knowable. We're only a day after the coup, already a technocratic government with constitutional authority set up. We have any sense of a realistic timeline to get to more parliamentary elections and sort of a constitutional framework and a coalition that people can start to point to as the next chapter here?
Dr. Albert and I predicted 6 months to a year in Egypt. Who knows?
Uncertainty reigns in Egypt, and that's probably an understatement. As supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood and ex-President Mohamed Morsi contemplate their future after having their guy removed from office forcibly, David Kirkpatrick, Cairo bureau chief for our partner in the New York Times. Thank you, David.
Glad to be here.
As we wrap up the hour on this 4th of July, our Independence Day, we wanted to leave you with this.
God bless America.
Well, if you're an American, you either love this song or you hate it. But you have to admit, this patriotic song does have a wide range. From Kate Smith belting out this show tune back in 1938, to Whitney Houston warming up the crowd at a boxing match in 2000, to the Mormon Tabernacle Choir showcasing the churchiness of the song, its evolutions and deep history is a story told by Cheryl Kaskowitz, author of God Bless America, The Surprising History of an Iconic Song. The book hits stores today on July 4th. And before John Hockenberry left for vacation, he sat down with Cheryl Kaskowitz, and as Cheryl explains, the song's unexpected rise to patriotic anthem is one that Irving Berlin himself certainly could have never imagined when he wrote it right after World War I.
It's very interesting to think about the context in 1938, where Irving Berlin was himself a Jewish immigrant and was writing a song invoking God. At the time, it was used as a symbol for religious tolerance, and especially in the wake of, you know, the growing violence in Europe by the Nazis. And it actually started out as a peace song. And originally, there was a line, an original line that was, "Let us all be grateful that we're far from there." And so it really positioned the song specifically as a move away from war, which I think from our perspective now, the way that the song is used in support of American war, that I think it's really interesting that it had this beginning of very much a stance away from war.
But it began as a show tune, pretty much.
Right, exactly. So Irving Berlin, the great songwriter of the 20th century, wrote the song in 1918 during World War I. He was drafted and serving as an army private at a camp in upstate New York, and they asked him to write a fundraising review, a musical. And so he originally wrote God Bless America as the finale to that show, which was an all-soldier show, but at the time decided not to include it, and it sat in this mythical trunk of rejected songs until 1938.
Why was it pulled out of the trunk?
Well, Kate Smith was a radio star, and she approached Irving Berlin looking for a song to sing for her Armistice Day radio show. And so the story goes that he thought of God Bless America and pulled it out at that point.
And then, of course, Irving Berlin performs on the Ed Sullivan Show. He's sort of trotted out to sing the song and to perform the song, you know, at various times during the 60s, including with President Nixon.
God bless America, land that I love.
At that point, what does the song begin to mean?
During the Vietnam War, the song was really taken up as a song in support of the administration and in support of the Vietnam War, and really as a kind of anthem for the status quo. I see God Bless America in the 1960s as a kind of counter-protest anthem to quiet dissent. And it really didn't
happen. In many ways, the message has changed from, here are our values, God Bless America, we have something to contribute to the world. It's become, hey, God is on our side. Stop criticizing us for what we're doing in Vietnam.
Yes, exactly. And I think that it was really in the 1960s and part of the upheaval of the Vietnam War and, you know, the rest of the social change movements that were going on in the 1960s that maybe solidified a little bit its meaning that's more, let's leave it alone. Though I should say, from the very beginning, in 1940, Woody Guthrie was not a fan of God Bless America, and he actually wrote This Land Is Your Land as a kind of protest against it.
In the shadow of the steeple, by the relief office, I saw my people as they stood there hungry. I stood there wondering, is this land made for you and me?
The Depression was still going on. There was a lot of struggle in the U.S. at that time that he felt like the song was glossing over. And so the original refrain for This Land Was Made for You and Me was, God blessed America for me.
Hmm. You've also got Bob Dylan writing With God on Our Side, this extremely ironic protest song that evokes a lot of the same notions of God Bless America, but in a very negative, nasty tone.
Oh, my name, it ain't nothing. My age, it means less. The country I come from is called the Midwest. I was taught and brought up there, the laws to abide, and that the land that I live in has God on its side.
There wasn't a whole lot of space for the left to claim the message of God Bless America by the 1960s. They didn't feel there was a lot to be proud of in America's conduct abroad. And, you know, there was a lot of reflection. And so a song that so confidently stated, you know, a love of country didn't feel appropriate at that time.
And then, of course, September 11th transformed the song once again. You talk about the celebrated performance of God Bless America by Diana Ross at Shea Stadium on the 21st of September in 2001. How do you see that?
Right. For that first game, that was the first game back, and Diana Ross sang God Bless America in a way that the song just had already taken on new meaning after the attacks.
In a few years, this song will be 100 years old. It will have spanned a century. It will have had many identity changes during that period of time. Do you think it's settled down, that it's going to pretty much reflect the identity that it has now forever? And I wonder what Irving Berlin would have made of all this.
I don't think that it's going to settle down. I think that it just continues to shift. Irving Berlin says that for him, the song was always about thanks to a country from an immigrant who had made good. That's where it came from for him. And I think many people have different associations with it, and it's hard to pin down. But there is something charged about it and powerful. And so whether you love it or can't stand it, it's accrued these meanings over time.
Well, quite a legacy for a simple, almost tossed away show tune by Irving Berlin. Cheryl Kaskowitz, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Cheryl Kaskowitz is the author of God Bless America, The Surprising History of an Iconic Song.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. Happy Independence Day.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.